Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to Classical Ideas. This is Greg Soden. In the last several years, I have done my best to pay attention to how spiritual traditions and religions have changed with the times. Change in society, politics, religion, and tradition is often difficult and comes with growing pains. A new book that jumped out at me recently is American Dharma, Buddhism Beyond Modernity, by Dr. Anne Gleig, and the book is out now from Yale Press. I wanted to have Dr. Gleig on the show to discuss online sanghas, which I have considered joining, deinstitutionalized Buddhism, and the modernization of Buddhism. This book contains debates around mindfulness, sex scandals, technology, and generational divides in Buddhist Dharma. I highly recommend it, not only because it's intriguing scholarship, but because it's just a great read if you are at all involved or interested in the American Buddhism scene. Dr. Anne Gleig is Associate Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Central Florida. She is co-editor of Homegrown Gurus, From Hinduism in America to American Hinduism, and has published widely on contemporary Buddhism. It was truly a pleasure to have her on the show, so please enjoy our conversation on her research and her new book, American Dharma. Dr. Anne Gleig, thank you so much for coming on Classical Ideas.
Thank you, Greg. Thanks for the invite.
You're totally welcome. Can you just spend a moment introducing yourself and tell us and the audience who you are and what you do?
Yeah, sure. Well, in short, I am a professor, an associate professor. I just recently got tenure.
Congratulations.
Thank you. of religion and cultural studies at the University of Central Florida. I'm from Liverpool, just to, in case the audience is startled by my accent. I'm not a native to Florida. And my research area is Buddhism in America, primarily.
Wonderful. How did you come to care about Buddhism as an academic? Like, what's the story, the backstory there?
The backstory is a long and kind of probably boring one to most people. But essentially, I was, you know, I had an existential interest in Buddhism and forms of Hinduism, especially kind of non-dual Buddhism and Hinduism. And so when it came, you know, it's time to go to university, age 18, I informed my mum to her distress that I was going to study theology and religious studies and not English literature, as she had assumed. And it was quite funny, actually, because the first thing she said was, "You're going to study theology. You haven't been to Mass for 3 years." I'm from a Catholic family, which also probably really shaped me. So I've always really been interested in religion.
Excellent. Well, and what's really interesting about your interest in English literature as well, is that so many of the allusions that we find in modern literature are biblical and religious in nature. So you kind of went back even farther in time.
Yeah. And also, actually, you know, thinking about it, you know, my earliest encounters, some of my earliest encounters as a teenager with Buddhism were really, you know, through literary forms, through, I guess what scholars call Beat Buddhism now, which is a very, you know, selective, romantic, American kind of version of Buddhism. So, you know, people like novelists like Jack Kerouac and poets like Allen Ginsberg. And so you know, literature is, yeah, definitely being a kind of close relation to religious studies for me too.
Fantastic. Well, something that really jumped out at me as I was reading your new book, American Dharma, which we will discuss at length momentarily, is the kind of similarities that you and I seem to maybe possibly have as far as our practice. I personally really enjoyed reading about your somewhat sporadic approaches to practicing in convert Buddhist groups, because I can relate. Like, this is how I've been in the past as well. And like right now, I'm not really practicing at all. But I think about it. What do you think is the reason for your sporadic practice over the years?
Sporadic approach. Yeah, I think, you know, I actually use that sentence when I'm locating myself as a researcher at the start of the book. So, yeah, just, you know, for those who haven't read the book, I'm in my mid-40s now, and I guess I've been practicing on and off in Buddhist groups since I was a teenager. Again, another complicated question, but I think essentially I would say that there's been times in which my intellectual and political commitments and interests have cohered with Buddhism, and times in which they have really conflicted. And the times where I felt a lot of conflict, it's normally, you know, I've just felt, you know, unable to practice. So some of it is, you know, struggles that I've felt kind of reconciling, you know, my feminist commitments, or, you know, just, I guess, just, you know, a real interest in history and kind of critical thought with certain, you know, Buddhist cultures. So I think some sanghas are more open to, you know, critical kind of thought, and their, you know, members kind of wrestling with other discourses and not just Buddhism. But I've been practicing quite consistently for let's see, I started to practice at Door Mountain. It's a Tibetan Buddhist group in Houston. The teachers are Ann Klein and Harvey Aronson. So I actually started practicing there when I was a grad student in 2004. So it's been quite a while now, about 15 years. But then I did move away from Houston. So that's, you know, some other different challenges, kind of pragmatic challenges. I think, you know, Buddhism is something that I kind of move closer to, and I move back and forth from, you know, at different periods of my life.
I completely relate. So I was really excited to see your new book come out recently, and it's from Yale Press. It's called American Dharma, and the subtitle struck me. It says, Buddhism Beyond Modernity. What is modernity in Buddhism?
That's another really hard question that really we could have the whole podcast just about, you know, what is modernity. So do you want me to talk about modernity as an historic period and a kind of cultural and intellectual project?
If you'd like. I mean, so all the terms that, sorry.
Well, I mean, I could talk about modernity as modernity, or I could talk about, you know, Buddhism in modernity, or what scholars, you know, call Buddhist modernism.
Yes, let's talk about Buddhist modernism. I feel like, yeah, that might be the most appropriate one.
Yeah, I think that would be kind of easier. So essentially, Buddhist modernism is a scholarly term. There's a few terms similar. So we also talk about Protestant Buddhism. We talk about modern Buddhism, Reform Buddhism. And it essentially refers to the forms of Buddhism that emerge from the encounter between traditional Asian Buddhism and Western modernity under the conditions of colonialism. So in Burma, Myanmar now, but Burma then, you know, was invaded by the British, and Buddhists in Burma responded to the challenge of, you know, the colonizing powers of Britain, and also the challenge of, you know, the religion that the colonizers brought, which was Christianity. And, you know, a similar process happened in Ceylon, Sri Lanka, and then also in countries that weren't directly colonized, Thailand and Japan. They, although they weren't directly colonized, they were responding to the challenge and, you know, the opportunity also of the of modernity, of the modern world. So some of those, you know, that they wanted to respond to, you know, claims around science, you know, the values of science, the value of the individual, the value of democracy, the values that, that mark modernity, the ideals of modernity. So often one of the things that Buddhists did was, you know, they basically, you know, presented forms of Buddhism that were compatible with modernity. So here is really, you know, it's really here is where really we see the birth of what Donald Lopez calls the scientific Buddha. So this is the kind of, you know, the image of the Buddha as a kind of early scientist who was, you know, Buddhism is, you know, a rational religion. And it's really the kind of Buddhism that's, you know, that you can kind of, the you can see the kind of air to it in the modern mindfulness movement and the dialogues between His Holiness the Dalai Lama and, you know, Western neuroscientists and international neuroscientists. So it's a particular form of Buddhism, you know, that really shows both, you know, influences from, you know, canonical kind of pre-modern Buddhism, but also the modern kind of world and values.
Okay, I see. So there's a lot of history that goes into this and a lot of, you know, cultural influence as well. And there's some terms in the book that people often hear today in the world, but they may or may not really get, like in simple terms, what they mean. So these terms are modernism, which we just discussed, postmodernism, post-colonialism, and post-secular. So I used to be in grad school from 2009 to 2012, and I used to read these terms so often in books, and it was, but it's been a while. And these terms sound great, and it might be uncool of me to say this, but I sometimes am not really 100% sure what some of these terms mean, especially now that I haven't been reading about them in several years. So I'm curious if we can just briefly set the record straight. You just described modernism. Can you describe sort of postmodernism as like a general theory? Because your book lays it out clearer than I think I've ever read it.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I mean, I just want to say, you know, all of the terms are contested terms. So even, you know, amongst academics, there's a lot of debate about what these terms mean. So I'm really going to give, you know, really kind of general kind of definitions here. But essentially, postmodernity is, you know, often dated around the mid-20th century. And it's essentially a kind of reaction against the modern world, or a reaction against, or a kind of disillusionment with some of the promises of the modern world. So one of the big narratives of the modern world was, like, modernity often defines itself in opposition to the traditional and often in opposition to the religious. So the idea, one of the ideas in modernity was, you know, science and reason are going to bring in this new age of progress. And, you know, there'll be this movement away from the superstition and the injustices of religion, you know, and we'll kind of march into this utopic kind of modern age. And so, you know, this idea of like progress, ethical progress and technological progress. But then, of course, you know, in the 20th century, the two world, you know, amongst other things, the two world wars happened. And so because, you know, science and kind of modern ways of thinking and organizing and systems, modern systems, were so involved in the world wars. It really kind of led, you know, for people to, you know, philosophers and cultural theorists to really question, you know, question modernity. So we often, you know, scholars often talk about postmodern as this period of skepticism of the big stories of modernity, you know, science as a kind of answer to everything. And so it's often, there's also a pushback against some of the other narratives of modernity, which is this idea of universalism and individualism. And so often we think about that the postmodern kind of brings in an appreciation of diversity, of pluralism, also just tends towards the relative, you know, the ethically relative.
Yeah, sure.
So it's, you know, it's basically a questioning of modernity. And then the post-secular. So one of the narratives also connected to modernity was the secularization thesis. And this was basically an idea in sociology, in which it was believed that, you know, basically, I'm using mankind, you know, like intentionally in quotations, you know, because the language was, you know, kind of androcentric then. But, you know, mankind would move out of religion altogether and would become eventually secular. So, you know, a lot of sociologists kind of predicted the death of religion, and that didn't happen. You know, religion didn't die. In fact, it kind of made a comeback. You know, there were these kind of fundamentalist kind of backlashes against liberalism and secularism. And then there was also the explosion of kind of spirituality, like the institutionalized forms of spirituality. So the post-secular is, you know, basically saying, you know, what comes after secularity? And it essentially kind of refit, you know, one of the marks of the post-secular is also a blurring of the lines between the secular and the religious. So I think, you know, one good example of this for non-academic audiences, if I haven't already lost you, sorry.
No, keep going. One
example is, you know, the mindfulness movement. So the mindfulness movement has garnered so much attention. And one of the big questions that, you know, many different, you know, scholars and practitioners have been wrestling with is the question of, is mindfulness religious? Is it Buddhist, or is it secular? And I think that, you know, it's both and neither. I mean, it's a phenomena that kind of really disrupts that boundary. So I think the mindfulness movement would be a great example of what the post-secular is. And then the post-colonial, you know, post-colonial refers to both the end of, you know, colonization as, you know, the nation, as colonized nations like India became, you know, gained independence, and also to a body of, you know, theory and literature which interrogates colonialism and offers, you know, liberation projects to, you know, enact post-colonialism on multiple levels. So in relationship to something like Buddhism, if you see, you know, if you see debates about, say, cultural appropriation in Buddhism, you know, they're often reflecting a kind of post-colonial sensibility. Or if you see debates around, you know, pointing out racism in white Buddhist sanghas, you know, they also reflect a kind of post-colonial sensibility. Where there's an interrogation, a questioning of some white Buddhist assumptions around what is real Buddhism, you know. So they are all academic terms, but I think that, you know, again, for non-academic readers, the best way to really get to the terms is through the case studies in the book, which I tried to write not really heavily theoretically, so they would be accessible.
Oh, they're definitely accessible. And so I was reading something, I just found it in the book, and it's early on, and you write about how the key modernist features of Buddhist modernism is a privileging of individual meditation practice, the neglect of elements discarded in the modernization process, such as Sangha and ritual, the psychologization of Buddhism, and the overwhelmingly white, liberal, middle, and upper middle class demographic. And these have increasingly come under scrutiny within American convert communities. So that to me is kind of like where the postmodern is reshaping rather than sort of like replacing, because all these things are coming under scrutiny rather than being destroyed, right?
Yeah, because I think, you know, again, postmodern, it is definitely a problematic term, but even the tradition, the modern doesn't even replace the traditional. You know, these are huge historic periods, and there's always counter narratives happening within, you know, historic periods. You know, the modern doesn't wipe out the traditional. So the terms are really, you have to use them loosely. But postmodernity, I would say, I think I define in the book is both a continuation of modernity, but also a reshaping or a correction of modernity. So it really kind of accounts for the multiplicity of Buddhist forms that you can find today. So you can find very, again, you know, my hands are up in quotation marks, you can find very traditionalist Buddhist sanghas, and then you can find spaces, you know, meditation studios where you don't even see the word Buddhism. But if you know Buddhism, you can kind of see the implicit Buddhist, you know, elements to the room. So I think, you know, it's a term that covers a broad amount of phenomena. But some of, you know, you pointed out the most pertinent ones.
Wonderful. Okay, so now when we look at the title, so earlier I talked about the modernism word in your title, and there's also another word in your title that I want to talk about, American Dharma. American. Yeah. So I want to talk about I want you to talk a little bit about the essential versus cultural Buddhism terms as well, and why this matters to American Buddhism.
So, yeah, no, that's a really good question. So I think essentially, you know, one of the kind of characteristics of Buddhism in America has been a distinction between, you know, what's often being expressed as essential Buddhism and cultural Buddhism. And scholars have used this distinction as well. In fact, in some ways it comes from an early typology that was distinguished between different forms of Buddhism in America. But basically, when used within sanghas, you know, by practitioners, the essential is as often referred to meditation or Buddhist philosophy, like enlightenment, you know, meditation as, you know, part of, you know, the path to liberation, that's like the heart of Buddhism, and that other aspects of Buddhism, such as community or ritual or devotion, have been kind of narrated as, oh, that's just cultural Buddhism, right? And then cultural Buddhism has been, that's a distinction that's often been made. And then there's also been a racialized alignment with that. So white Americans have been aligned with, you know, essential Buddhism, like they're doing the real, you know, the real Buddhism, the heart of Buddhism. And then Asian American, you know, heritage communities have been aligned with cultural Buddhism. Now, of course, that sets up a racialized hierarchy, right, where white Buddhists are kind of at the top of the, you know, at the top of the mountain doing the real thing. And Asian American Buddhists are seen as, you know, doing these non-essential elements. So, you know, there's some, you know, really problematic racial issues there. So I think that's, you know, even though, you know, white Buddhists, including, you know, white Buddhist scholars, I want to kind of include myself here, you know, have been slow to kind of catch on. You know, Asian American Buddhists for, you know, decades have been saying, hey, you know, this is really, you know, this is a violence towards our communities. But I think now, you know, what you'll find is, you know, these great articles, and I think Lion's Roar, there was a great article called We've Been Here All Along by Funi Su, who is a academic and Buddhist practitioner, where she basically talks about this distinction, problematizes the distinction. So I use, you know, that article and another work, you know, on that in that vein as, you know, evidence towards this post-colonial, post-modern kind of sensibility across American Buddhism. You know, because before, you know, you wouldn't really see that being interrogated in the, you know, in the Buddhist media as much.
I'm definitely going to find that article. That's a good recommendation.
Yeah, and also I think you recently interview Duncan Williams?
Sure did. Yeah, that was great.
So yeah, so you know, his work, of course, is really so important in, you know, illuminating the fact that, you know, while most of, you know, the, you know, while a lot of the Buddhist mainstream press has been focusing on white convert lineages and, you know, Japanese Buddhists had been, you know, keeping Buddhism alive in America for, you know, for decades under intense conditions of violence and oppression. So I think, you know, both, you know, white convert practitioners and also, again, I want to include myself, you know, white Buddhist scholars who focused on convert lineages, you know, were really, really being schooled, you know, appropriately. And I'm sure, you know, we've taken a while to kind of wake up to this.
Yeah. Well, okay. So you mentioned earlier the mindfulness movement. I kind of want to go back to that for a second.
Yeah.
There's been like a deluge of articles the last few years in every popular newspaper in the country about, you know, what you call, on page two of your book says, scientifically proven benefits of mindfulness and meditation practice. What does science and scientists and brain scientists currently agree upon related to mindfulness practices?
That's a great question. And I actually think that they don't agree on things. So essentially, you know, again, you know, this is kind of repicking up that, you know, the modernist scientific Buddha lineage. And essentially, you know, mindfulness kind of exploded in a way out of nowhere, you know, suddenly was on, you know, the front cover of Time magazine, and, you know, everyone was doing mindfulness. You can find mindfulness books in the airport and at the supermarket. And one of the things that was driving, you know, that drove and continues, I guess, to drive this explosion was, you know, the scientific backing and legitimacy of mindfulness. So you did see, you know, all of these studies claiming, you know, making these quite big claims about, you know, mindfulness, only 10 minutes of mindfulness can rewire your brain. Mm. And things like this. And then there was a kind of backlash, you know, against these studies. And I kind of detail that in, you know, in the second chapter in my book. But I think that, you know, essentially the backlash happened on multiple levels. But one of the levels was, you know, basically pointing out that the scientific, you know, claims were actually, you know, not as founded as they seem to be. So I don't know the particulars. You know, I actually don't follow scientific studies very closely. I'm more interested in the rhetoric of science and how that operates within Buddhist communities and the backlash against that. But I think that, you know, mostly, you know, that a big problem was with this. It was a hype. There was a massive overhype of the science of mindfulness. And so I just want to, I think there's a great article that's probably available online. I think it's actually called Don't Believe the Hype. And it's by Kathy Kerr. And I think it's in Tricycle magazine. But Kathy was a neuroscientist. She died tragically of cancer, and she was a great loss, I think, to the Buddhist and neuroscientific community. She's a really wonderful human as well. But she really discusses, you know, very carefully the scientific claims as a neuroscientist herself. So I just think what you see in magazines, I don't think the science actually, you know, backs that up. But I do think there are some scientific studies that do show, you know, more modest benefits of mindfulness.
Okay, so that's kind of what the scientists think. So now I'm curious what you know about what the Buddhists think. So there's like this huge push to secularize mindfulness practices, which in the past, as you mentioned earlier, has been associated with religion. So this is sometimes referred to as Mick mindfulness as well, which I find entertaining. Has this created any conflict and schism within American Buddhism? Cool with it and who's not cool with it?
it's caused a lot of schism.
And yeah.
It's actually, I think, also produced a couple of people's careers for them as well. So that's not a bad thing. So basically, there's a big division. So on the one hand, you know, there are some of the, you know, most well-known American Buddhist teachers, Jack Kornfield, Joseph Goldstein, I think Norman Fisher from the Zen world, have been, you know, really supporters of secular mindfulness. Thich Nhat Hanh is also, you know, Vietnamese monk Thich Nhat Hanh has also been a supporter of, you know, taking mindfulness into non kind of Buddhist contexts. So on the one hand, you've got these Buddhists, you know, Buddhist modernists essentially, who are, and of course, John Kabat-Zinn is a, you know, kind of the at the very forefront. So they're kind of, they have, you know, been at the forefront of the mindfulness movement. And then there's been a backlash. So I'd say the backlash, I'd say there's two main groups against secular mindfulness. So I would say some of them are against secular mindfulness as more traditionalist Buddhists. So they are, I think Alan Wallace is probably a good example. So Alan Wallace would be someone, Alan Wallace, and I think it was Ajahn, Jeff, Thanissiro, Bhikkhu, they basically, I think it was him, but they look at how like secular mindfulness is different from mindfulness in the Satipatthana Sutta and in the context of the Pali Canon. So they're basically, especially Alan Wallace, is basically arguing that secular mindfulness is a very diluted version of what, you know, right mindfulness is in the Pali Canon. So you could, that's a kind of traditionalist critique. And then there's another group who are against mindfulness, and they're probably best, you know, categorized as engaged Buddhists. So I'd say maybe, you know, David Loy and Ron Peirce's article Beyond Mac Mindfulness. I think you say Mac. I say Mac Mindfulness, but I noticed you said Mick Mindfulness.
So oh yeah, sorry, that's my American Midwest upbringing.
I think Americans say that, so maybe it's a different thing. But essentially, they critique mindfulness less from a traditionalist perspective and more from a kind of neo-Marxist perspective. So they're concerned by the ways in which mindfulness is becoming a tool of kind of corporate America. You know, so they're concerned that, you know, corporations, you know, are paying their workers, you know, low wages and making them work like long hours. And instead of improving, you know, those structural conditions, you know, they're bringing in, you know, mindfulness trainings. So they're basically, that group of Buddhists who are against mindfulness, in a way, are basically, you know, saying mindfulness is kind of functioning as a kind of opium, you know, a kind of contemporary kind of opium of the workers, opium of the people. So they basically combine a kind of traditionalist and a kind of neo-Marxist, for want of a better word, critique. But that's very distinct from a traditionalist perspective, right? Because in the Pali Canon, the Buddha's not talking about, you know, structural work conditions, you know, it's a different concern. So I think it's important to kind of note the difference between, you know, traditionalists and kind of neo-Marxist Buddhist critiques.
Interesting. Okay, so something that also plagues the Buddhist world are sex scandals, which you spend a lot of time on the book discussing. In the past, there's a Facebook Zen group that I follow, and some people get really bent out of shape whenever sex scandals are brought up on the discussion group. And, you know, I had a past guest on the show, Michael Downing, who wrote well-known Shoes Outside the Door about San Francisco Zen Center, which documents their sex scandal in the 1980s, and Richard Baker Roshi. So the people on the Facebook group are saying things like, move on from this. Why are we still discussing this? Yet these types of scandals continue, and you list a lot in the book, like Meizumi Roshi, Genpo Merzel, Dai Bosatsu, Joshu Sasaki, Chogyam Trumpa, Osel Tenzin, Sogyal Rinpoche, and more. So what's going on with American Buddhism with regards to gender and sex abuse? How is that? Are things improving? Is this challenging of modernism making changes happening?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you really captured it yourself. I mean, if only we could move on. You know, I think everyone, you know, would like to move on, but as you know, as the fact is that these abuses have been, you know, reoccurring quite consistently since, you know, the 1980s, really. So it's really kind of, wow, 40 years into, you know, these sex abuses. It's quite, I'd say, well, I think that, I'm not sure I would necessarily frame it as a postmodern challenge to modern Buddhism, because I think a lot of modernist Buddhists have also been wrestling, you know, with the issue of sexual abuse and sexual misconduct.
Definitely fair.
So I think there's probably, you know, there's a few different responses. I mean, one main response has been to, you know, I think there's been a kind of recognition. Let's take the example of Soto Zen, because Soto Zen Buddhism has done quite a bit of work in basically, you know, teachers like Grace Shryerson, Barry Majid, have basically called for more kind of psychological kind of training as part of, you know, Zen training. So, you know, thinking about work on, you know, what's kind of appropriate boundaries, you know, how to negotiate, you know, power in, you know, Buddhist, you know, sanghas. So I think there's, you know, there's many Buddhists who want to bring in, you know, outside discourses, like psychotherapy or, you know, boundary training and communication trainings into Buddhist sanghas in order to help, you know, prevent these kind of abuses happening as a kind of preventative tool. So that's one big response. And then there's another response, which is, you know, the problem is that, you know, the sex abuse and sex misconduct has happened because teachers and sanghas haven't paid enough attention to Buddhist ethics. So that group, you know, rather than say we need psychological and psychodynamic training, they say we need to follow, you know, we need to follow and take the Buddhist, you know, sexual ethical precepts more seriously. So, you know, so that's another response. And then, you know, I think there's a third response as well, definitely of people who, well, you kind of pointed it out, you know, people who say, you know, it's not really an issue. You know, some people will say, oh, that one teacher did it, you know, but it's not like a systematic issue. So they do the kind of Buddhist bad apple approach where they just kind of target a teacher and they say, you know, wherever they might come up with different reasons why that teacher's gone kind of bad, but they essentially say this is not an issue that sanghas need to, you know, really tackle. It's more just these, you know, individual bad guys, you know. And then, you know, there's also I'd say a fourth group who actually don't really even accept that these are sexual abuse issues. That might say, you know, well, I don't know if you've been following some of the Tibetan cases, but, you know, in Rigpa, you know, there's many students of Rigpa who fully support Sogyal Lakar, you know, Sogyal Rinpoche. And they say, you know, the acts of violence that were publicly documented were actually, and sexual violence and physical violence, you know, were actually some form of teaching, you know, a kind of crazy wisdom teaching. So you have really got so many different narratives in the Buddhist communities, you know, as a response to these abuses. And it is an area where you are seeing, I think, tensions between progressive and, you know, conservative Buddhists. So, you know, some progressive Buddhists have taken inspiration from the Me Too movement and they've had, you know, like debates or workshops or even, you know, retreats on, you know, what's the impact of Buddhism for, you know, sorry, what's the impact of Me Too for Buddhism? And then, you know, others who are saying, you know, that's got no place in Buddhism and, you know, this is just progressives like ruining our tradition. So it is actually it's actually the topic of my latest book. I'm working on a book just on sexual abuse in American Buddhism with Dr. Amy Langenberg, who's a specialist in sexual ethics in classical Buddhism. She's a textualist, so we're kind of joining forces. But it is so fascinating to both of us because you do see in the different responses to the sexual abuse, you do see all of these different kind of subsets of Buddhists, you know.
Yeah. Well, and something else just jumped out at me too, the way that some people would say, you know, that's not a problem, or they would downplay it, or they would say that that's a teaching. And that really That actually scares me. That makes me very nervous because, you know, I'm a parent and I'm like, what if my child ever happens to go into a, you know, a group where those types of things happen? And what if I go into a group like that? And those types of things just really scare me.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's funny you should say that because I was part of a panel at the American Academy of Religion in 2018. I guess it was just last year. And there were four or five of us on the panel, scholars and a journalist who works on Buddhist sexual abuse in Holland, and also one of the directors of Faith Trust, which is an organization that has gone into Buddhist communities who are dealing with sexual abuse and misconduct scandals, to kind of work with them and, you know, help them kind of work through it and kind of reshape. And the respondent to the panel was Sarah Jacoby. She's an amazing scholar of Tibetan Buddhism. And she opened her response by, you know, she was kind of saying the same thing, you know, like, what Buddhist group would I feel comfortable, you know, sending my daughter to? And I found it extremely powerful. But, you know, some others, you know, it was interesting because another Buddhist in the audience, you know, came up to me afterwards and said, you know, one that even though she found, you know, Sarah's response very, you know, powerful in other ways, that, you know, one of the things that she was worried about was the ways in which, you know, the sexual abuse and misconduct scandals had, you know, tainted the whole of Buddhism and kind of also inadvertently, you know, erased, you know, these great female Buddhist teachers, you know, and males as well. I mean, I definitely, you know, think there's been some, you know, there's definitely plenty of male Buddhist teachers who haven't been, you know, involved in sex scandals. But, you know, she wanted to point out, you know, there are these great teachers and these great sanghas where there's not sexual, you know, misconduct and abuse. So one of the things that we want to do in our new project, Amy and I, Dr. Langenberg and I, is we're going to look at the Zen Center of Los Angeles, and the Roshi there, her name is, I've forgotten her full name, but she they're doing a really amazing thing where they've compiled it's a sutta, it's a kind of modern day sutta, and it's basically, it documents a history of abuse that happened, you know, in the Los Angeles Zen Center in the 1980s, but also shows the way they move forward as a community. And so it's like a practice book. It's really an extraordinary kind of document. So I think that's, you know, one really kind of positive, kind of, you know, hopeful way, you know, for Buddhist sanghas in America to confront this kind of lineage of sexual abuse and misconduct, and to kind of, you know, move forward, you know, because I think, you know, if you have that kind of transparency to the history, like being honest, this is what happened and this is how we worked with it, you know, I think that, you know, I know for me as a, you know, as a queer female, that would make me feel, you know, really safe in that sangha.
I'm glad that we were able to squeeze some positive hopefulness out of that last little segment to look towards the future. Because, yeah. Anyway, so we can never talk about this entire book. There's so much in this book, but there's a section that jumped out at me. I was born in 1983, and a few years ago, as I was discovering podcasts, I just typed Buddhism into my podcast apps. And Buddhist Geeks jumped out at me.
Oh, yeah.
So what fascinated you about the Buddhist Geeks organization?
Yeah, well, it's quite interesting, actually. I kind of stumbled on them. I actually stumbled on them by accident. It was really a very fortuitous accident because I did actually really enjoy the research. But I had some research money left over. And so I was kind of, you know, it's just in academia, it's like if you don't use your research money at the end of the year, you lose it.
Yeah.
It rarely carries over, you know. So I had a chunk of research money. I was at Millsaps College at the time. And I was just kind of looking out for, I wanted to go to a conference. And I can't remember exactly, it probably popped up on Facebook, knowing me. I saw, you know, the Buddhist Geeks Conference. And I'd actually missed the first one. It was the second one. It was the first one in Boulder. think it might have been 2012. So I thought, oh, I'll go and give this a shot. And I was a little intimidated because I wasn't really a tech person. So I didn't automatically gravitate, to that group. But when I went to the actual conference, I was really kind of struck by the energy. There was just a tremendous amount of kind of energy and excitement, and it was had a really different vibe than a lot of the other Buddhist events I'd been, kind of attending. It was very, there was a lot of millennials there. It was kind of formatted in a very different way than any retreat or Buddhist conference I'd ever been to. So that really kind of, I just kind of really got my curiosity going, and then I, just kind of got on a bit of a field work role with it.
Okay. So one of the things I'm curious about is how you see the Buddhist Geeks organization being important generationally, as it like a distinction between boomers, Gen X, and like millennial teachers. In what way are they different?
Oh gosh. Yeah. I think they are like, I think that they're really important. I think that, Vince and Emily Horn, the co-founders, and I think there's Ryan, someone else whose name I've forgotten, sorry, Ryan. They presented themselves as millennials. So they were, they were really, I think, amongst maybe the first Buddhists that I'd kind of, worked with who explicitly kind of claim the identity of millennial Buddhists. And I think, a big distinction they made between, because, I think of Buddhist Geeks as a millennial rather than a Gen X, kind mm-hmm. of project. So I did the chapter later on the Gen X teachers for the book, but I'm a Gen Xer, so I'm more comfortable with Gen X. But I think with the millennials, a distinguishing feature of them is, their literacy in, social media and technology, and how comfortable they kind of are with that kind of hybridity, and bringing Buddhist practice into, these technological, on the surface, secular spaces, and really kind of, mixing that up. So they had, a lot of metaphors of like, they talk about hacking the Dharma, they take these like metaphors from, like computer and tech stuff and apply it to their approach to Buddhism. So it was very kind of bricolage, which is a very postmodern quality, where you have these kind of disparate elements kind of brought together. And also they were really talking at the time, because I think Vince's kind of gone through a lot of, I think he's in a different place now. He kind of, he killed Buddhist Geeks and then rebirthed it. But now he's really talking about Metta Dharma. But at the time he was, questioning, Buddhism as a kind of, main narrative. And so he was thinking more, more about like, what do the discourses of technology tell us? So it would just fit really well into a postmodern kind of framework for me, really.
Gotcha. I know they've received a lot of backlash as well for about their discussions of psychedelics in meditation. What's going on there?
Well, to be honest, I'm not really up on that conversation, because that kind of was, I think that's a kind of recent thing. I think about 6 months ago. They did that. I think they did a conference in LA on psychedelic Dharma, and then there was a lot of backlash. And so I think essentially, I've not been following this too closely because, just for various reasons, I've been working on other stuff. But there seems to have become quite a big crossover between, the Buddhist world and the psychedelic kind of ayahuasca kind of community. And, that's got historical precedent because, of course, the psychedelic kind of counterculture in the 1960s, was a massive kind of receptacle for Buddhism. A lot of the kind of big figures, in Buddhism and also in American Hinduism, thinking here particularly of, Ram Dass, Richard, Alpert, they basically, took LSD and then, wanted to continue the exploration of consciousness that they had experienced through LSD you know, by getting into, you know, Buddhism and Hinduism, or the forms of Buddhism and Hinduism that kind of came through guru traditions. So you've always had that crossover. I guess that's what I want to say. There's always been, I think, a crossover between Buddhism and hallucinogenics. But I think, you know, it was like big, and then, you know, Buddhists kind of, you know, were like, hey, you know, we can't keep taking LSD because, you know, for various reasons, including the fact that it's one of the precepts is no. Because I mean, essentially, that's, you know, one of the conflicts, right? Like, one of the precepts is no intoxicants. So Buddhists who are against the psychedelic Buddhist kind of ayahuasca crossover, you know, are pointing that out, you know. So I think, I know Brad Warner has written, he's a Zen teacher, but he's written a lot on, you know, he really thinks, you know, poorly of this kind of psychedelic Buddhism.
Gotcha.
So, it's really interesting, all of these different subcultures. It's just keeping me in a job for, I guess.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Glog, I have a couple more questions for you that are hopefully are kind of quick. Can you tell us or predict, make any predictions about the future of online sanghas and meditation apps? Do you think those things are going to flourish, or will we back away from them?
I think, you know, I think both, I mean, you know, if I can be like terribly postmodern, I'd say both and.
Okay.
You know, one thing that was interesting to me, even over the course of the book, I think it probably took about 3 years to write, you know, was I noticed that at the start, you know, of those 3 years, you know, there were online sanghas, especially connected to pragmatic dharma, that seemed, you know, really flourishing. You know, that when I'd visit the pages, there was like daily debate and people were, you know, sharing their meditation experience and sharing meditation tips. And then, you know, I'd go back to them like, you know, over the course of the 3 years, and they just disappeared. And it was like, wow, there'd been no activity for like 3 months, you know. So I think you are, you know, I think there is definitely going to be these, you know, very, you know, short term sanghas. You know, I think that, I guess one thing I'm seeing online is that sanghas online often form around particular issues. So issues that, you know, that they're not finding in their, you know, main street, their local sanghas. So maybe they want to talk about, you know, a certain type of meditation practice, and their local meditation group isn't doing that meditation. So, you know, it serves a certain purpose, and then it like, they get what they need, and then it kind of like disappears. So I think that will continue. I think there'll be a proliferation of, you know, temporal sangha, online sanghas around specific issues or meditation practices or issues of, you know, sexual abuse, you know, maybe responses. But then on the other hand, I do think that, you know, online sanghas for many Buddhists are a kind of lifeline. And I think it's also, you know, connected to geography. So, you know, many online Buddhists have reported to me, you know, if it wasn't for this online sangha, you know, I would just be practicing alone. You know, there's no, you know, I live in, you know, rural X, and the nearest Buddhist, you know, place is 50 miles away, and I can't drive there. Or so I think that, you know, there's definitely, you know, long-term stable communities that will continue. And then I think you're also seeing a lot of hybrid sanghas, which, you know, have physical locations, but also attract, you know, people, you know, not just nationally, but also internationally. And then, you know, and kind of live streaming of teachings, like the group I'm in, you know, Houston, I just go to one retreat a year there. And, but we, you know, they do retreats all throughout the year. And there's, you know, there's people that Skype in from Europe and, you know, all over the States. So I think that's, you know, and also I think that's going to definitely just continue, these kind of hybrid kind of Buddhist sanghas.
Do you remember when you submitted the final draft of your book to Yale Press?
When did I submit? I can't remember. I think it was a January, and it was probably the January before it came out. So when did it come out?
Well, the book is just out this year.
It's just out. Okay, sorry. So I'm just so sorry. It's the end of semester.
Was it January 2018 that you submitted it?
It must have been January 2018.
Okay, so
it was just over a year in press.
So here's my question. Yeah. What has happened since you finished the book that you wish was in it?
Wow, that's a really good question. Okay, the one thing that I do wish that was in it was, it's a theoretical thing which might not be as interesting to you, but the category of the metamodern is kind of like burst, you know, into kind of popularity. And the metamodern is, you know, what some literary and cultural theorists kind of say has replaced the postmodern. You know, so they say, you know, okay, there's pre-modern, the modern, the postmodern, and now it's a metamodern. And, you know, there just seems to be a lot of excitement around the metamodern. So I'm kind of wishing, you know, I'd kind of included it in my last chapter, where I do, you know, I do reflect on a number of models like the postmodern, the postcolonial, the ultramodern, multiple modernities. I don't know if it would give more than what's already in there, but I think that it would, you know, attract more readers to the book, which, you know, is a good thing. And then just in terms of, you know, what's been happening in Buddhism since then, I mean, what's most interest to me, and some of the reason why, to be honest, I didn't pay that much to the kind of attention to the psychedelic stuff is, you know, the sexual abuse and sexual misconduct kind of scandals. So that's, you know, really what my kind of scholarly kind of attention is on right now. And also, I think you are starting to see a lot of really intense and actually sometimes quite nasty kind of arguments around progressive Buddhism. You know, there's a massive backlash. It's actually maybe not even right to call it a backlash, because the opposition has been, you know, there was a front lash, you know, and there was a middle lash as well. But, you know, it's kind of interesting to me, even just tracking some of the responses to my scholarship. You know, a lot of, you know, people who I seem to identify as Buddhists are, you know, seem to be really upset at the chapter on racism and white privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there is just, you know, a lot of, or even like, you know, gender politics. Why are you bringing the Me Too movement into Buddhism? So it's quite interesting, because some of the debates, you know, they're more kind of like debates that you probably think that you would find on like Fox News, you know. So they use language like snowflake Buddhists, and, you know, this is a kind of leftist takeover of Buddhism.
Wow.
That's really interesting to me, because demographically, you know, scholars have generally said convert Buddhism as politically liberal. So the fact that you're seeing what reads as kind of quite right-wing, reactionary, sometimes even I would go as far as to say alt-right kind of statements in Buddhist circles is just really fascinating to me. So that's kind of what I'm, you know, tracking currently and in the future probably.
Well, I look forward to reading more of your work as well. American Dharma, Buddhism Beyond Modernity is a really, really good read. And I'm really grateful to you for squeezing in me into your schedule and having this conversation.
Oh, thanks, Greg. I'm sorry if I've been a little incoherent and rambly. It's been a really long semester.
Absolutely. Well, go and have a nice evening.
You too. Thanks a lot. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Classical Ideas is produced by me, Greg Soden. Music on Classical Ideas is composed and performed by Derek Strybig. You can find his music at www.wearewarmmusic.com. If you like this show, please rate it on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can email me at classicalideas@outlook.com or find me on Patreon at patreon.com/classicalideaspodcast. Thanks so much for listening.